Hello, I'm Daniel Christenwahl, author of Designing Regenerative Cultures.
And I'm Philippa Duffy, Oceania Director at the RSA. You're listening to Series 2 of Regeneration Rising, a podcast exploring how we can create a thriving home for all on our planet. In this episode, we're thrilled to be joined by Nora Bateson. Nora is an award-winning filmmaker, artist, lecturer, research designer, and author. She is the founder and creator of Warm Data and the practices of the Warm Data Lab. Nora is the author of two books, Small Arcs of Larger Circles, and her recent release, Combining. She also wrote, directed, and produced the documentary An Ecology of Mind, a filmic portrait of her father, Gregory Bateson. Her work brings together the fields of biology, cognition, art, anthropology, psychology, and information technology into a study of the patterns in an ecology of living systems. Nora, thank you so much for being here. Your work looks at the relationships and dynamics within and between complex systems. Can you explain for our listeners what this means?
Well, it's easy, okay, to talk about interconnectedness, which maybe 15 years ago it wasn't so easy. But now that language is much more prevalent. I mean, you hear commercials by British Petroleum or Starbucks talking about interconnectedness. I think what I am trying to do is to bring some of the rich relational combining and moving of processes that's actually taking place in that interconnectedness into the possibility of being perceived. So I'm interested not about systems. There's a lot of work that's about complexity and systems theory and ecologies. I am trying to produce possibilities for experiencing what it is to be within them. So for me, one of the things that's so important is to shift our idea of information from being something that is actually static to something that has aliveness. In other words, has movement, is changing. And for many centuries, information has been sort of locked into a static, and I would argue dead place. So it's like a difference in attention from labeling and identifying to, what you do when you watch a bird fly or you run to catch a ball where you're actually engaging with something that's in motion. Life is in motion. And the second it's not in motion, it's actually not alive. So I am concerned of how it's possible to receive information and respond to that information in a way that actually continues to produce vitality. If we're using information that's dead, it seems unlikely that our response will actually produce more life. So that means we need new language. That means we need to look in new ways, have kind of possibilities of sensitizing, not just to those things that we could point to as interconnected, but sensitizing to the cadences, the rhythms, the tones that they move in. So that's where the warm data comes in. That's kind of what I've been working on from my more academic papers to poetry to improvisational conversation techniques, etc. So moving that way of knowing from knowing about to knowing within.
And can you just explain the concept of warm data for listeners who haven't come across this term before?
You could just say it's information that's alive, okay? And if you think about that, it's pretty radical because for so long we've produced information by pulling things out of context. And then we can label them, measure them, and we can define them. We can point to them. They become an it, a thing. But if you put them back, whatever it is, a butterfly, you can pin it to a board and you can study all sorts of things about it. It's not going to tell you anything about how that butterfly is in relationship in first order, second order, nth order relationship with all the other organisms in the meadow. So we are desperately lacking a kind of information that allows for, second and nth order relational process. That's one way you could describe it. I think the actual definition sounds something like it's transcontextual information about how a system is coming together. And this word transcontextual is really important to me because it's recognizing that things are produced through the history of lots of different kinds of relationships, right? Historical relationships of culture, of religion, of various kinds of aesthetic, of craft, of technology, of the ecology and the relationship to the seasons, of relationship to food and our own health and digestion, of relationship to ways of thinking about how we know and how we communicate, ways of thinking about art. So in every moment, the thing we think we're talking about is not just that and nothing more. I mean, a glass of water, it's not just that and nothing more. There is so much. If you start to follow out all the relational processes in a single glass of water, you're going to start to see that they are interlapping. They are they're in a sort of reciprocal implicationing process that leads to all sorts of things, from the history of the mountain that I live on and the Vikings that were once here, to the agriculture and the farmers, to the political bodies of Stockholm proper, to so. This attention pulls us out of the convenience and the habit of the subjectification and control. If I just say this is a glass of water, it's not that it's wrong, but it's a huge abstraction from what this actually is. And, you know, when we're talking about a glass of water, it's you can kind of not care about that. But when someone says something about you that is abstracted and you think, yeah, but that's not who I am, you can feel the violence there, right? And if I say, oh, well, you know, I'm a filmmaker, or I'm Gregory Bateson's daughter. Okay, people do that to me all the time. She's Gregory Bateson's daughter. And immediately I'm like, yeah, but there's a lot more happening. It's not that I'm not, but there's a lot of other stuff that I am besides that. And so even that is a pretty menial example. Now, when you start to look at the way people are describing entire ecosystems and groupings of people who are justifying the exploitation of, you can start to feel the violence of what happens when that warm data is gone. So for me, the importance of this process of becoming more practiced, okay, practicing, perceiving these multiple contextual processes as they are in motion together, it has the possibility to make us a little more humble, a little more careful, to tend to those relationships that we might otherwise just stomp on without thinking about it.
I need to follow up briefly because this is so juicy already. Because for me, this is pointing to the heart of regeneration in the sense that, like Carol Sanford beautifully says, you can't do regeneration in the abstract. You have to do it in the specificity of place and context and culture. And it also points towards this shift away from the labeling, classifying way of seeing the world. Like Blake famously said, may God us keep from single vision and Newton's sleep. And staying conscious of the dimension of mind in how information as participation actually brings the world into form. And so, and we constantly think we open our eyes and there's a world out there, like the world of dead objects. But the world is alive through the act of cognitive interaction of one part of this dynamic interconnected whole perceiving itself in the act of participation. And for me, that's the major shift that we're talking about when we're talking about regeneration, that we stop this solving problems in the abstract and then finding solutions to ever more abstract defined problems. And then we're surprised that those solutions don't fit when the economists have given us the money to scale them out and force them into every place. So together with this labeling, we've also got into thinking in globalities. And what we actually need to do is we need to think in specificities, in the local enactment of life everywhere. Does that resonate?
Oh, yeah. And it's fascinating because, I mean, for me, my grandfather, William Bateson, 135 years ago in the hallowed halls of Cambridge University, was a biologist, and he coined the term genetics. And at the same time, eugenics was coming. And the difference between the two is very important. And he fought desperately to keep genetics out of eugenics. Eugenics was about defining in the abstract various typologies and producing a way to produce them, right? And genetics was about the study of how things change. And that's not the same thing. One of them had a goal and the other one didn't. And I think, you know, 135 years later, we are looking at a whole, I'm going to use the word ecology of institutions that are interdependent, that are patterned into each other, that are reliant and absolutely built on the foundations of that type of linear control. And it stems from our creation story, you know, and if that story is caught in eugenics, which it was, I mean, psychology, education, economics, the health system, all of that stuff was being brewed right at the, you know, edge of the industrial moment. And the industrial moment asked for control, asked for productivity, optimization, efficiency, deliverables, preconceived outcomes. And so this habit is deep and deadly. It's deadly. And so I think, you know, I'm with Carol all the way that the complexity is not in the model, it's in the details. It's in the way that the details produce new pathways of possibility. So if you create the model up here in the abstract, in the map and not in the territory, you miss the actual possibilities as they are coming to be in an ecological way. So it's an error of, you know, really not thinking like an ecology, thinking like a factory and not like a meadow.
As you were speaking, I was very strongly reminded of that wonderful passage of Thich Nhat Hanh's comments on the Diamond Sutra, where he speaks about interbeing and why he thinks the term interbeing is worth bringing into the dictionary. And he unfolds it with a sheet of paper and how in the sheet of paper there's the logger and they're the parents of the logger and the loaf of bread that fed the logger and the sunshine and the rain and the clouds. Mm-hmm. And of course, that is the indigenous wisdom of all my relations. It's all like wherever you pull on the web of life, also bad metaphor, but it's all hitched together. That's one dimension of it. And the other is the one that we also already spoke about. the second or third level observer capability of how am I observing, like to step out of one's own process and realize one's own perceptive habits. Have you found in your own practice, in your way of working with people, gentle invitations into these ways of perceiving?
I love this question. And so I made this thing called a warm data lab. And in the warm data lab, there's a question that a group of people enter together. And the question might be something like, I don't know, what is home in a changing world? Okay, that's a very carefully crafted question, by the way, because home has a lot of complexity in it. And when you add in a changing world, you keep it from being static. So it's not the question, what is home? It's how is home changing? So there's that motion that we were talking about. And you might be with three or four people and you're in the context of economy or ecology or family or politics or tech or whatever, right? So one of the things that happens here, and it happens pretty quickly, there's a difference between saying, look at all of the relations in this glass of water, and what happens internally when people's own memories, their own stories, their own experiences take on those multi-relational memories. So this is where I might be talking about education and I might have a memory and then I start to realize, oh, this is attached to this, it's attached to that, that goes this way and that way. And I hear somebody else talking about their story and I'm thinking, wow, isn't it interesting that they perceive it that way? And there I just perceived my own perception and I also see my own memories existing in entirely different landscapes of relational history. But it's only possible in conversation with each other. So people start to perceive that other people are perceiving things in really different ways than they were. And that shows you kind of where the edges of your own thinking was, your own language. But then also recognizing, oh, this event that I have in my mind that happened to me didn't really happen to me. It happened in a lot of other relational causal processes. And that's a big movement, especially in terms of healing, in terms of looking at questions of trauma. And the next expression becomes, how do we being whoever's in that grouping, begin to respond to this together?
When you shared that beautiful question from the Warm Data Labs, what is home in a changing world? And then what you just said now is maybe, again, in designing regenerative cultures, I repeat somewhat ad nauseum that the way to re-enter the core pattern of us being regenerative expressions of life is not by finding the answers and the solutions, but by living the questions more deeply together. And I feel that relates to exactly that. It's that epistemological shift where we go into collectively exploring in through our participation together around the table with a question, how we can bring forth reality together. And we create these, as you were describing, these opportunities to perceive from different angles, rather than sitting there and going, no, we need to come with an outcome and what's the outcome document and we need to publish something at the end of this conference and blah, 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 a manifesto and all of that. And so what I'm hearing is this living the question is actually a pathway into us undoing these habits of perception that are trapping us in this dead universe of objective information.
So we live in a world that is already completely transcontextual, interdependent, alive with all of this process. And more often than not, when we go to talk about something, We split all these things apart, and suddenly we're talking about history, about politics, about family, about this, about that. But interestingly, we actually live where all those things are always combining. If you tell a story from your life, any story, a personal story from your life, in that story, no matter what it is, you will find all the contexts of our world. They're there. So that story will include history. It will include culture. It will include family. It will include ecology. It will include economics and politics. It will include technology. No matter what it is, it's got all of those contextual processes in it because we are already within them. And honestly, you're right, Daniel. It is so hard for people to perceive because it actually looks, well, it's invisible. Right? You're not tending the things. There's nothing to measure because you're working with not just the relational process, not just the communication in the system, but what it's possible to communicate. Where does that live? Right? So we're so used to thinking that we can map out and strategize these models of solution. And first it's let's change the things. We have to change the economy, change the education system, change the political system. And then it's, oh, we have to change the relationship between them because that's actually where the issue is. And then it's, well, if we're going to change the relationship, we have to actually tend the communication. But there's a whole different world. And this is the ecological space, which is the what was it possible to communicate? And that lives somewhere else. That lives in the premises that we do share. The premises of what's in it for me, the premises of the question, what's the point? The premises of where is this going? How will I know? There are these sort of, you know, consequences of industrial living that we don't know that we're in anymore, but they inhabit everything we do. What's the point? Where's it going? What's it going to do? How will I know? What's in it for me? And these things are so implicit, they're so tacit, but they drive us. And so we're in another set of responses there of now, how do we think about what is possible to do with each other? Who can you be when you're with me? How can I let you know that I love you and that I respect you and that I'm curious about the multitudes that you are? Who can you be when you're with me? That's an ecological question. That is tapping into the practice, okay? And it is a practice of perceiving how relationships shift relationships shift relationships. You are not you, and I am not me. I'm different when I'm with you. You're different when you're with me. So what does it mean to be an honest person? What does it mean to be a good person or a person of integrity? Because in some relationships, that honesty looks one way. And in other relationships, it looks a different way. It must, because we are living in complex living systems and we have to respond differently. You shouldn't trust every situation you're in. But that other question, who can you be when you're with me? That's my work. In allowing your complexity. So how are we resonating? What can I allow to open here? Where can we go? Where can our learning move?
And we can extend that wonderful question to all of life, not just to another human being, to a relationship with a plant, a landscape. I've always loved the Australian practice that when you do a webinar with somebody in Australia, they always start off with honoring the original custodians of the land that they're on. And one of the most insightful and striking moments in this entire, like the first series, the second episode, we spoke to Professor Anne Paulina, an Aborigine elder from Australia and also university professor. And I knew that that's an Aborigine custom. But what I didn't know and that Anne Paulina shared in that conversation is that when she's on country with her people, They hardly speak, she said. They hardly use language, but they're constantly in communication. And I find that in all we're talking about, language takes us into the abstract so quickly. It takes us into the labeling. And I would love to hear your take on the Jungian mandala of the four ways of knowing, where thinking is just one of them, and thinking is the one that is expressed in language. Like, how do you relate to that sort of map of the four ways of knowing that Jung proposed with regard to warm data?
There's so much communication that's nonverbal. Even in the conversation we're having right here, there is so much that's taking place that's not in the words that we're saying. And even though we're on Zoom and we can't, you know, be in our analog world together, there are entire vistas of things we're not discussing because they're implied. Words we're not using, and by not using them, we are making a statement. So there's this world in which, especially, you know, sort of with warm data, what we're looking at is there's a lot of information that's not on the script. If you look at our conversation, I would say that at least 80% of the responses are actually taking place in nonverbal ways, in ways that are implicit or invisible. So what that says to me is that there is a huge territory of possibility for other kinds of communication, for other possibilities and ways of knowing. Now, you asked about sensing, intuiting. There's no other word for it. I'm just irritated quite a bit of the time because I hear a lot of language that maybe once was a translation from other cultures into some sort of English around what this idea might mean of whatever it is, sharing, caring, collaboration. But the language, when it arrives now, it lands in kind of an existing soup of New Age self-help, of all sorts of sort of spiritual endeavors that have been kind of contaminated from a lot of different directions, from profiteering to kind of glory hunting. So, you know, it's very difficult to get it out of that and to actually feel and hear and know when people are talking about knowing something in their heart or in their body. That language is really very difficult to get it back. So my question around this in a way is, how do we get out of the scripts that put people to sleep? Attending conferences on, you know, basically everything from climate change to regenerative economies to, you know, new education programs, the language that is proliferating in these spaces that are hoping for change is language that is actually asleep. It's dormative. It's so scripted. It's so rehearsed. It's so lost from the raw experience of life that it isn't actually communicating that anymore. And that's the thing that we desperately need. So for me, the question is it possible to start having conversations that are totally unrehearsed? And what does that feel like? What does it look like? How can we begin to actually, you know, begin to go into places we haven't been before together? Because in those places, that's where the reliance moves from the abstract, from the language, from the mapping of the last several hundred years of academia, science, engineering, etc., into a deeper connection to our microbiome, our the fact that you are only 1/10 human. This something more ancient and more alive. But one doesn't go there unless one has to. If there's a script that's in easy reaching distance, you reach for it. if there's a way to produce a set of signals that say, I am credible, please love me, here's my signals, this is where I belong, it's just too easy to do that. So the way in which the old wisdoms, the old cultures, the way in which that sensitivity is needed right now is just immeasurable.
A few times throughout this conversation, you've touched on love, and in particular that need, which is inherent in all of us, to be loved, to be valued, and how that, you know, desire for connection is communicated or recognized. And I just wondered if you could say a bit more about how you see love working within this transcontextual dynamic.
It's interesting because sometimes we have a very romanticized idea of love. And I would like to bring that into another frame as well. I like romantic love, but I also appreciate the way that right now my heart is pumping blood that goes all the way to my toes. And that there's a sort of generosity there that isn't altruistic. It's about life, making life. It's not a holdback. If my heart stops pumping blood to my toes, it's going to be a problem for this entire organism that is my body, right? So there's something about that generosity, that being in life together, where there's a shift. It's not, what are we going to get out of this? It's not, where is this going? It's perfectly obvious. The blood has to pump to the toes because life. And there is no reason. There is no end, right? The blood pumps to the toes because generations from now, there will be some great, 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 great grandchild in the dirt with soil under its fingernails.
That's such a beautiful description. And I think that fundamental generosity is, you know, something that we too often overlook or take for granted. And yet it's what anchors us in that wider story of life on this planet.
The only thing, like what comes up a little bit, is in this world where so much of the narrative right now is captured around a fear of the future and collapse of systems. And in many ways, if we take the scientific lens and look realistically at where we're at, it's understandable that these conversations are in the collective, because we're waking up to a situation that we've created for ourselves. How do you sit with all this anxiety around needing to act in the face of calamity at this point? And how do you overall feel that if we only get out of our learned habitual ways enough and let life flow through us enough, which it does anyway, because your heart is still pumping blood to your toes and so is mine, that we can actually relax into this adventure a little bit more and therefore cherish it more?
I think I just have to say, and I know that you've been here too. I've been here for a long time. I grew up sitting at dinner tables with people who were deeply concerned and wanting to respond with emergency level responses 50 years ago. And the issue is that the response to the situation has to be of a different order, a different approach, a whole different perception. If the attempt at making a solution is imbued with the same industrial thinking that's creating the problem, it only perpetuates it. And so the approach to the way that we keep responding to things is informed inherently with a common sense that is out of symbiosis. And so the responses we make are also out of symbiosis. And so what does the response look like that is responding to the situations that are in urgent need, but is responding to them with a whole different approach. And you cannot have a group of people in a room responding to an urgent situation in which that situation is the only situation they think they're going to apply their systemic thinking to. And then they leave the room and they're not very kind to their partner, and they, you know, are out of systemic thinking in every other way, except for when they enter the situation room. And then they think they're going to apply this as a professional tool. No, no, no. It has to run right the way through you. And so for me, having grown up around my dad and the way that he responded to situations, whether they were helping someone with alcoholism or tending to a, you know, infrastructure of a city or what have you, his response was never the one that was in the program of this, the existing system. So I became sensitized to that difference of what it looks like to respond to a difficult situation when you are actually perceiving all the relational process around this glass of water. How do you respond, right? So if you are an emergency medical team and you show up to attend to someone who's overdosing, and you as a medical practitioner see that person on the ground as a tax to society, a loser, someone who's lost their way, just another program, a political issue, right? The way that you touch that person is very different. The tone in your voice, the look in your eye, the way you speak with your other team members is completely different than if you perceive that person who is overdosing as part of a larger set of very complex situations. And your care for them is in the same tonality as the blood that goes to your toes. And when they open their eyes, the person they see and the possibilities they see for their own future, who can you be when you're with me, changes. It changes everything, even in acute emergency, where obviously the practitioner has to do what they do. They have to inject the pharmaceutical. But it's not just that and nothing more. It really is not. So we can point to the climate change and we can say, look at all the particulate in the sky, we have to get it out. And then we can also look at the way that an individual in our world finds credibility, finds love, finds respectability. And what you will notice is that those processes of producing those relationships that are so vital to the human soul are entwined completely with material production. So do we have particulate in the sky because there's stuff flying up there? Or do we have particulate in the sky because I want you to love me?
We've been skirting around something that I feel like when we speak about life, and particularly with your family history, with your grandfather and your father, also asking that question, what is life? How does it evolve? Somewhere in that time when we started genetics and all of that thinking, that we have a perception of life that story unfolds in individuals and species. And I find it's a Kuhnian gestalt switch cube. You know that cube where you never know what forward and back. Of course you can build an entire science on seeing life through individual actors, individuals and species acting in a scenery of what we call environment or the biosphere. But if we switch that cube and just as validly see life as a planetary process that has never been separated, only through our categorizing mind have we become individuals and species. For me, that points at another real, almost jugular of what we've been talking about the entire time, our perception of death and life and how we understand our relationship to mortality. Because we're in that separated story that has these supposedly separate individuals and species supposedly competing against each other. And yes, there's competition, but it's the waves on a surface of symbiosis and being together, being in life together, you said. How do we overcome our fear of mortality at this point where breakdown and collapse in many spheres of life will become part of our story more and more? I think we're at a moment as a species where it's literally a rite of passage. If we don't re-perceive what life is and how we are related in life together, and if we continue our fear of death, I think we're just spiraling around this until it's too late. And the beauty is that the minute you flip it, nothing is ever too late, because everything is just part of that living planet moving forward. Life continues, but so much of our pathological behavior comes from the misunderstanding of actually who we are in life together.
I find that when I am working with people who are in communities that have been really betrayed by the system, they've just been left behind and used and abused and kicked to the side, that the struggle that is perceived there is perceived as coming from multiple directions. It's not linear. It doesn't take very much to actually be in a conversation about the multiple processes that have produced that struggle that is existential. However, by contrast, when I am working with people who are very comfortable in the existing system, the perception that that comfort has been derived by linear means is very difficult to shake. So there's something, I think, about the dark night, about the experience, and coming back to cultures that knew this before, okay? They had things like vision quests, experiences into which you have to go to realize that you are not alone. You face it down. Whatever it is, you know, these things come in many shapes and forms in different parts of the world. But basically, these experiences are ones in which the individual has to go beyond the edges of their individualism. So your own mortality is belittled by the larger processes that you are clearly within and interdependent upon. But we don't have those anymore. And there's something big that's lost there, because it isn't. I remember when I was giving birth to my daughter, that there was a moment in that process. I had a natural childbirth where I thought, I can't do this. I don't know how I'm going to do this. I don't know how to do this. But in that moment, there was also something that I was watching the wind blow out the bathroom window and the leaves were flipping. And somehow that reminded me that I was part of life and that life knows how to do this. I don't know how to do it, but life knows how to do this. Every bear, every puppy, everything has already done this. So all I have to do is lean in. And remember, it's not me doing this. This is life. A lot of vision quests are based on the birthing experience. Also, attending death, being with someone who is dying. Again, there is something beyond our clutching to the day-to-day experience that pulls us into relationship with those that are gone and those that have not yet become, and life itself. So those experiences can, okay, there's no promise. There's no methodology for this. You can't fake it. You can't force it. You can't, you know, say what it should be and measure how well someone's got the lesson. But I think there has been a time when, and in cultures where it was sort of a given that if you hadn't had those experiences, you were actually not really ready to be a participant in the community because you haven't touched that space yet. And that makes you dangerous, reckless, aligned to all the wrong senses of priorities.
Nora, you've recently released a new book called Combining, which follows on from the book that you released in 2016, Small Arcs of Larger Circles. And I just wondered if you could share a little bit about that book just to finish up today.
Small Arcs of Larger Circles is a book that is systems thinking. It's not about systems thinking. It is systems thinking. And so it has lots of little pieces in it. Some of them are chunky and, you know, research pieces, and some of them are philosophical, and some of them are sexy, and some of them are tragic, and some of them are. And what I wanted to do was bring a lot of pieces in that on their own, they don't tell the story. But when they combine in you, the reader, they become part of a larger story, a larger way of looking, a larger perception. So they're little pieces that are there to combine in you. And the way they combine in you is different than the way they're going to combine in my kids, right? So that is a sort of, it's a poem. Basically, it's a big poem that is producing its own reflections and impressions and movements and is shifting in you. And I wanted to do that because the one thing I really didn't want to do was to tell people how to think about systems, because that seems inherently unsystemic. And so I really wanted to allow that room for movement, okay? And that's so important, is this movement. So that the way that those pieces sit with you now is different than how they sit with you later. It's not like there's one idea and that is just what it is. There's movement in it. Of course, a lot of people didn't understand what I was up to there because they were looking for something about system thinking and they were like, well, how come she never says it? But it is, it's everywhere. It's just that it's nowhere. All right. If you go into the forest and you try to find the forest, it's everywhere, but it's nowhere. It's not in the organisms. But it's in the organisms. Where's the forest? Where's the meadow? And so then I started working with warm data, and that book definitely is warm data. It is it. It never says it. It just is it. I think it maybe says it once. This new book is called Combining, and that's what it is. It's combining. It's looking at lots of different things that are combining in different textures, different tonalities, different ideas, different cultures, different storytellers, combining. And this recognition that life is produced in this combining process. So it is that ever combining, recombining, the moire of how patterns that when overlaid with patterns reveal new patterns, new sensitivities, new ideas come out of the combinings, possibilities come out of the combinings. So I think that's what it is it's about the possibilities.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed episode 3 of Regeneration Rising series 2. If this episode has inspired your thinking, please check out the show notes for links and resources and to find out how you can be part of the regeneration.
In celebration of the launch of Regeneration Rising, we're offering a special promotion for listeners to join our global community of RSA Fellows. Our fellowship is a network of over 31,000 innovators, educators, and entrepreneurs committed to finding better ways of thinking, acting, and delivering change. To receive a 25% discount off your first year of membership and a waived registration fee, visit thersa.org and use the discount code RSAPOD on your application form. See the show notes for terms and conditions.